You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
Researchers asked cis people if they would date trans people. The headline read, and so as not to keep us in suspense, the subhead let us know that the news was not good. The results of the first ever study on this subject were bleak. Sex researcher and recent Savage Lovecast guest Justin Lee Miller wrote up the results of the study for Vice, which is where I encountered that headline and that subhead. The results were published in the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships. Researchers pulled nearly 1,000 adults, mostly Canadian, skewing younger, queers overrepresented in the sample. With those caveated, 98% of respondents identified as cisgendered, a.k.a. not trans. Lay Miller writes, how many cisgender people are open to the idea of dating a transgender partner? Overall, 87.5% of participants said they would not be open to dating someone who is trans. In other words, Lay Miller continues, just 1 in 8 people expressed willingness to date a trans man, trans woman, or both. Just 1 in 8. The gang over at Them, Condé Nast's online LGBTQ publication, framed the results this way. The new study measures, quote, the extent of trans discrimination when it comes to romantic and sexual relationships, and considering, quote, the discrimination trans people face on a daily basis, it comes as no surprise that trans people are overlooked when it comes to dating. Because just 1 in 8. Let's back up, zoom out a little bit. Gays and lesbians were more open to dating trans men and women, nearly a quarter of them, while just 3% of straight people were open to dating trans folks. But 1 in 8 cisgendered people, sissies for short, were open to dating trans men and trans women. And that's 12.5% of the sissies out there. And that is bad news about cis people and bad news for trans people. And it's bad news that Vice and Them and everyone I saw tweeting about this study wants us to feel bad about. But is it bad news? If 12.5% of the population is open to dating trans people, that means there are more people open to dating trans people than there are people out there open to dating, well, me. Okay, I'm going to step outside my comfort zone here, really far outside it, and do some gulp math. There are roughly 130 adult women in the United States and 125 million adult men, for a total of 255 million adult Americans. 0.06% of the population is trans, according to the best available estimate. So subtract those 1.4 million trans adults from that 255 million total adults, and we're left with 253.6 million American sissies. 12.5% of 253.6 million is 31,700,000 people. More than 30 million sissies open to dating trans folks. It's hard to say exactly how many men are gay and bi. Estimates range from 2.2% of adult males, according to the Centers for Disease Control, to 7.7% of adult males, according to the National Survey of Sexual Health and Behavior. If the 2.2% figure is correct, 1.8% gay, 0.4% bi, that means there are 2,750,000 gay and bi men out there open to dating men. If it's the higher figure, 7.7% of the population, 5.8% gay, 1.9% bi, that means there are 9,625,000 gay and bi men out there open to dating other men, like me. Which means there are anywhere between 3 and 11 times as many people out there open to dating a trans person as there are men open to dating, well, me. Not that I'm looking, I'm taken, but you know, just as a thought experiment. For lesbians, the odds are a little worse. Just using the high-end numbers from the National Survey for Sexual Health and Behavior, 5.1% of adult Americans identify as either lesbian, 1.5%, or bi, 3.6%. So lesbians are looking at 6,630,000 female folks out there, at least open to dating them, compared again to the well over 30 million folks out there, at least open to dating a trans person. So how exactly are the results of this study bad news about cis folks or for trans folks? Sure, it could be better news. The percentage of the population willing to date trans men and women could be 25% or 50%. And open to dating does not equal actually dating, actually would date, or actually have dated. and the results of the study could be skewed by some high-minded virtue signaling on the part of some of the study's participants. But the results would have to be awfully skewed to bring the numbers of people open to dating trans folks down to the much, much lower numbers of men and women who are open to dating members of their own sex. So here's my headline. 12.5% ain't too shabby. And that percentage has to be a lot larger now than it was a decade or two ago. There's no research for comparison, first ever study of its kind, remember, but it's hard to believe the number was larger pre-Laverne Cox. Also, as more and more trans people come out and live openly as trans people, and more cis people meet trans people or meet the trans people they already know, the percentage of people who are at least open to dating a trans person is likely to continue to rise, which, in fairness to Justin Lay Miller, he pointed out in his piece at Vice. The study, Lay Miller writes, may underestimate cis people's true openness to dating trans partners, perhaps because they don't personally know anyone who is trans and they're basing their responses on stereotypes. If they were to meet someone who is trans, maybe they would change their mind. We hear about that sort of thing on this show all the time. A person who wasn't open to dating someone who is bi or kinky or pos or trans changes their mind after meeting someone that they were attracted to who is bi or kinky or pos or trans or, in some rare instances, all of the above. All too often, the default spin on LGBT anything is negative. We're always looking for those black linings and whatever silver clouds are up in the sky, or we're looking for clouds and cloudless skies because our victimization is real and we're used to playing the victim card, and the victim card is often the right card to play, and sometimes it's literally the only card we have in our hand. But this wasn't one of those times. And the spin that this study got was the wrong spin. Because if we do want to see the number of sissies open to dating trans people grow, study finds sucky cis people don't want to date amazing trans people is the wrong spin. The spin you want is this. Study finds a large and likely growing number of cis people are open to dating amazing trans people. All right, coming up on today's show, on the micro edition of the Savage Lovecast, tons of your Q's and a lot of my big fat A's. And on the Magnum subscription edition of the Savage Lovecast that you can subscribe to at savagelovecast.com. The Magnum edition is twice as long, no ads. TV's Guy Branum joins us to talk about his new memoir, My Life as a Goddess, and tackle a couple of questions from my listeners. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Everlane, luxury basic clothing and accessories made at ethical factories without those retail markups. For free shipping and to support the Lovecast, go to everlane.com/savage. Today's episode is brought to you by Stamps.com. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. And right now you can enjoy the stamp service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in my code, SAVAGE. That's Stamps.com, click the mic. Enter Savage.
Hi, Dan. I'm a Magnum subscriber, and I'm hoping that you can help me with a situation that I'm finding pretty distressing. So my mom died in September 2017, and my dad and her at the time had been married for 35 years. My dad started dating somebody January or February 2018, and plans for Christmas have started coming up, and he wants to bring his girlfriend to Christmas. My brother and sister are saying that if he insists on bringing her, they won't come. I think that they're not ready, and I'm not really ready to have a stepmom. And so the idea of seeing my dad with someone new is difficult. And it puts me in the position of having to choose between my dad or my siblings at Christmas time. And so I told my dad that at about 10 months into his relationship and a little over a year since mom died, I don't really appreciate being put in that circumstance, and that I would choose my siblings over him this year because I think he should just be more understanding that they're not ready. And then he said, well, what about 2019? And I said, look, I think it's too early to plan 2 years down the road for a relationship that's less than 6 months. but if you stay together, then I'll reverse my opinion and have Christmas with you rather than my siblings. So I told some of my friends about this and had mixed reactions. Some said, you know, yes, my dad's being unreasonable. Others said, I'm being selfish and immature, and I just wanted your take on it.
I'm sorry for your loss. It hasn't even been a year since your mother died. My heart goes out to you. I lost my mother a decade and change ago now, and it still gives me pain. I'm still grieving that loss. So my heart goes out to you. My heart goes out to your siblings. My heart goes out to your dad, who lost his partner of 35 years, lost his wife of 35 years, his romantic and intimate partner of 35 years. There is this difference, though, in the grief experienced by children when a parent dies and the grief experienced by a husband or wife when their spouse dies. And the difference is often stark, because if your mom was ill for a very long time, your father, in many ways, already grieved that relationship, because their relationship changed in fundamental and profound ways. Again, if your mother had a long, slow decline before her death. When someone becomes caretaker and nurse, that is an important, loving, intimate role, but it is a different role than spouse, husband, or wife. And people who have become the caretaker, they grieve the spouse, husband, wife relationship even before their spouse has died. Doesn't mean they aren't devastated. Doesn't mean they don't love their partner. They're loving their partner, but playing a different role for their partner. And they're grieving the relationship and what it once meant, because when someone is dying slowly over a year or two, what the relationship once was predeceases the ailing person. So the day your mother died, you lost your mom. Your dad had already lost his wife, potentially, depending on how ill she was and for how long she was ill, before her death. And he may have been ready to get out there and start living again a little sooner than you and your siblings are comfortable with. But you need to put yourself into his experience. You need to project yourself into his emotional experience of his spouse's death, which is different than your experience of your mother's death. It seems to me that you and your siblings are being unfair to your dad. It hasn't even been a year yet. It was several months after your mother's death that he began dating again. You guys aren't comfortable meeting this woman at Christmas. Your dad seems to be willing to accommodate your discomfort and to allow you guys to grieve longer. His response to, I have to pick between you and my siblings, wasn't to start throwing bombs or issuing ultimatums or rewriting wills. His response was, what about next Christmas? So he's willing to negotiate, willing to accommodate, willing to take into consideration your grief and where you guys are at. You need to do the same for him. You need to be willing to take into consideration his grief and where he is at, and recognize that you guys are at different stages of the grieving process. If Christmas seems too fraught, if the emotional stakes seem too high, if the first Christmas without your mother last year was incredibly painful, and you guys aren't ready yet for the second Christmas without your mother to include evidence that your father didn't die too, that he is still living and still alive and still making intimate connections with people, and that's not a betrayal of your mother. I would hope that your mother, as so many people do at the end of their lives, when they're going to predecease their partners, that she wished for him to continue to live and to continue to have love and experiences and joy in his life, that she didn't expect him to die with her emotionally, if not physically. Your dad seems to be haggling, would seem to be the wrong word. I don't know how to describe this, these negotiations you're having with your father about your siblings and their feelings and Christmas and the stakes, but he seems willing to negotiate, to compromise, to accommodate where you guys are at. Take Christmas off the table. Do Christmas with your siblings. Grieve your mother for one last second Christmas. Always remember your mother at Christmas. I remember my mother at Christmas every year. But take one last Christmas just for yourselves and your siblings. But meet with this woman and your dad before then. Let her know that if she's important to your father and this relationship has legs and it goes, that one day you will be ready to embrace her. But right now it's still too raw. There's still too much pain. It's still too soon. It hasn't even been a year yet. And so instead of attacking her, attacking your father, instead of recriminations, just acknowledgement of the pain and the grief and where you're at versus where he's at, what you're ready for, what you're not ready for, but some gesture that points to a future where you will be ready to accept and embrace her and your dad's life after your mother's death, a life that he's entitled to live. So get together for dinner. Maybe do Thanksgiving with your dad and his girlfriend. Just you, if your siblings don't want to come. And then definitely one party in 2019. If they're still together a year from now, you guys need to welcome her into the family.
Hey, Dan. Straight male. Damn. Man. I was just at the store buying ties. And then I had this whole conversation with this girl that was working there. I felt like it was going very well. At one point, she had a business card, and it didn't have her name on it because I guess she was just part-time. And I said, that's messed up. They didn't even put your name on the business card. And she said, oh, you're right. And she put it down. She wrote it down. And then she was Arab, and she spoke Arabic, and I've taken Arabic. So I wrote the name in Arabic, and then I fucked it up. And then I thought in the moment, I was like, oh, I got follow-up to this. So I was like, oh, but I bet if you would have wrote your number down, I could have wrote that in Arabic well. And I thought that was pretty good. And she's like, oh, nice try, like playfully. But nonetheless, nice try, as in great. It's not going anywhere, apparently. And it was in front of people, Dan. It's embarrassing. And it sucks because in the moment, you think maybe something's going well, and so you give it a go. And if you don't try to ask a person out, then you beat yourself up after for not having the balls or the ovaries, whatever, to do it. But then if you do it and then you get shut down like that, it's embarrassing. So my question, I guess, is like, I know you talk about the fact that it's not necessary to protect the male ego for women. And I get that. I understand it's not their job or anything. But I feel like you're a little critical on that because, man, it is kind of fucked up for your ego. And I mean, not that necessarily needs protecting, but I mean, it's, I don't know about most guys, but I'm a pretty confident guy generally, but that really kind of hurts my ego now. So, I mean, next time I'm going to think twice about kind of taking that chance. And I feel like maybe there is some efficacy to protecting the male ego to an extent, because men are the ones who are doing all the asking out and making the moves. And if you get shut down, especially if it's a consistent thing, it really hurts your ego. So maybe it should be protected in a certain way. You know, if some girl asked me out and I wasn't into her, I would try my best to not make her feel bad about it because I would appreciate it. So, of course, other advice will be, oh, just get back out there and do it. But, you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of striking out lately, Mr. Savage, and it really fucking, you know, jokes aside, it really, you know, it hurts, man. It doesn't feel good. It makes you feel sad.
All of this giant pity party because of nice try also overheard. There were other people around when she shot you down so cruelly. What would have been better had she given you her number, given you a fake number so that you wouldn't lose face in front of whoever else might have been around? Then you'd be calling me, as some other men have called me, to complain about how bitches give you fake numbers and that's rude and inconsiderate and blah, blah, blah. Sorry, I'm just going to have to tell you to do what you don't want to do, which is suck it the fuck up. Rejection happens. You were engaged in a playful conversation with this woman. It sounds like you had a friendly interaction with a stranger, and you asked her for her number in a playful way. I don't think it was manipulative or dishonest or deceitful. You were talking in Arabic, and you wrote her name down in Arabic, and you asked for her phone number to write it down in Arabic. It was just playful. It was flirtatious. And you don't know what's up with her. You don't know whether she's got a boyfriend. You don't know whether she's married. You don't know whether she's a lesbian. You don't know her at all. And rather than give you her phone number and then shoot you down via text or give you a fake phone number, she said, hey, that was a nice try, which was her way of saying and a perfectly fine way of saying, just like your way of asking for a number was perfectly fine. You didn't say, may I please have your number because I would like to ask you out on a date and continue to explore this connection that we are clearly having. You playfully asked her number. She playfully said, I'm not going to give you my number, which was her right. And also it was a signal from her that if your interest in her was romantic, you can stop wasting your time on her now because it's not going to happen. That's considerate. When someone gives you a direct answer to an ask, guys are complaining to me all the time that women don't give them direct answers. That women are like, oh yeah, let's hang out sometime. And the guy lives in false hope because women are socialized not to say no to men. Men are scary. Men can be violent. Women have legitimate reasons to deflect as opposed to be direct when a man is asking her for something that he wants. And here you had a woman be direct and you're calling me to complain about it because it hurts your ego. Yeah, rejection sucks. It always hurts. But this woman rejects you. That woman rejects you. Finally, you ask somebody out who accepts you. And then that's so sweet because acceptance is so much sweeter than rejection, but also the contrast between these experiences. Having gotten shot down previously, when you land it, when you get the number, you get the date, or you get the girl, or you get the guy, that experience is made more intensely pleasurable and rewarding and satisfying because it's in contrast to the rejections you had experienced previously. So, yeah, she shot you down, and that sucks, and that hurts. Should men be protected? Men are expected to do the asking out. Men don't do all the asking out. I've seen plenty of women hit on men in my time. Men are expected to do the asking out. Should women be courteous? Yeah, and direct. Courteous and direct. It sounds like that's exactly what she was. Courteous and direct. You asked her out while other people were standing around listening. You put her on the spot. She rejected you while other people were standing around listening, putting you on the spot. You didn't receive anything at her hands that you weren't meeting out to her. But I guess I'm not entirely sure what you're positing or suggesting when you say that men should be protected, that their egos should be protected. People should be considerate. People shouldn't be cruel or vicious. She didn't look at you and say, no way, never. She didn't say that you were ugly. She didn't say that you were unattractive. She didn't laugh in your face and say, nice try. She said, that was a good one. Nice try. Trying to get my phone number. Lots of guys try to get my phone number. Something else that men have to bear in mind when they're approaching women. Women get approached constantly. That is its own burden. Men have to do, most men traditionally have to do the approaching. That is a burden. But to be approached constantly by men, to be always on the receiving end of that male attention, those asks, for all you know, you were the 10th guy that morning or that afternoon that asked for her number or flirted with her, asked her out. She could have been exhausted from the emotional labor of gently deflecting the attention and the requests from men all fucking day long. Wrap this pity party up, caller. You got shot down. It happens, guys. Women move through the day feeling like they're getting shot up. Everybody's got their fucking cross to bear. No pity parties.
Hi, Dan. I am a 30-year-old queer female human, and I have a question about sexting. I have been sending increasingly explicit text messages back and forth with this guy for about a year, and I don't know about the safest way to do that. I'm really turned on by the idea of sending pictures and videos, but is there like a grown-up version of Snapchat out there? What are the real risks here? I just have been Googling around and nothing really seems to answer my questions. And I don't really know where to go. So I'm looking for a safer sex guide for sexting.
There's no Snapchat out there for grownups that makes sexting safe. Sexting always involves some risks, sending people dirty pictures, swapping dirty pictures. You don't know what that person's going to do with those photographs. If everything's friendly now, but things take a turn, revenge porn is a thing. It's a thing that's illegal in more and more jurisdictions and should be illegal everywhere. There should be a federal law that makes it possible to go after revenge pornographers, but it's a risk. You've got to really trust the person you're sharing photographs with, whatever app you're using, because they can go anywhere in an instant. They are replicable, infinitely replicable. And so the rule is, you know, if it's out there and it's going to destroy your life, maybe don't put it out there. But sexting, really does improve a lot of relationships. It really is how people flirt these days. And it's not just how people flirt with near strangers. It's also how people in long-term relationships crank each other up. They sex, they send photographs back and forth. And then they exist. They exist in the world. There are apps. Instagram has a way to send a photograph that disappears after its first viewing. Snapchat, of course, disappears, but people can take screen grabs of those photographs before they disappear. And then those are out there. And once they're on Tumblr, there's no pulling them back. So if you couldn't live with your tits being on the internet for all eternity, don't take photographs of your tits and send them out, or your butt or your dick or your pussy or whatever else. Because it's possible. It could happen. I, for one, am looking forward to the future where images making their way onto the internet, dirty pictures, sexts, is just not an issue because everybody's got something out there somewhere. Actually, I think that day is here now. I think pretty much everyone does have something out there right now somewhere. So this is going to become less toxic, less problematic over time. But if you're a school teacher just lost her job because a video of her doing a pole dance found its way to her colleagues and students. She's losing her job, even though pole dancing is a legit exercise routine taught in malls across middle America and red state America, whatever. Lost her job because that video. This is still a problem. It's still a risk. And if you're uncomfortable with this risk, the only way to eliminate it is to not sext. But who wants to live in a world where you can't send somebody you're interested in a picture of your junk? You shouldn't have to restock your basic clothes more often than your toothpaste. When it comes to clothes, it's so worth it to get some well-made, good-looking threads that you can wear for a good long time. With Everlane's quality, you'll be set. Everlane started with a basic t-shirt and a simple but bold idea that they could set a new standard for the retail industry. They are built on three pillars. One, Everlane makes beautiful, long-lasting products, so they only use high-quality materials, and they are trend-averse. They are not a fast fashion brand. That leads to a lot of waste in the retail industry. Instead, they are focused on making classic clothing that can be worn year after year. Pillar number two, ethics. Everlane only works with ethical factories, constantly vetting and evaluating factors like fair wages and safety. They're also environmentally conscious. For example, their denim factory, unlike most manufacturers that produce tons of waste, recycles 98% of its water waste. They also repurpose byproduct and send it off to a local brick factory, which then uses it to build affordable housing. Pillar number three, transparency in pricing. Everlane reveals how much each item costs, from materials to labor to transportation, and what their markup is. They believe their customers have a right to know how much their clothes cost to make. Everlane's timeless essentials are just what you're looking for. No frills, just quality. Terry and I both love the clothing we've gotten from Everlane. So does Nancy, and Nancy, like Terry, is picky. And right now you can check out my personalized collection at everlane.com/savage. Plus, you'll get free shipping on your first order. That's everlane.com/savage, everlane.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 27-year-old bisexual female. I live in Georgia, and I have a question for you about polyamory. So I've been with my current partner for about 2 years. He's amazing. He knows that I'm bisexual, and one of the first things he told me when we started dating was that if I ever wanted to date a woman, that's totally fine, not a deal breaker for him at all. For a while, I was just so in the throes of being in love with him that I didn't even think about it, but now we've kind of settled in. We have a great relationship. I feel really strong and solid in our relationship. And now suddenly I'm finding that I'm feeling less and less of my queer identity in my day-to-day life because I'm in a heterosexual relationship. And so a big part of me is like, you know what? I'm going to go talk to some girls, see what happens. And I told him that I wanted to do that, and he's been on board the whole time. So I have the freedom to go and do this and talk to people and talk to women. And I'm fucking terrified of women, I've discovered now. I don't know how to talk to them. I feel like a huge gross troll every time I get near a woman. I have no idea. I feel like a gross, creepy, predatory man when I talk to them. And so I'm not sure what to do or how to get over that. And on top of that, I'm having some trouble coming to terms with, like, my partner's just letting me do this and trust me. And I don't know if push comes to shove, if he would want to do something like this and go outside of our relationship, if I would be okay with it. So I have a lot of guilt going on because of that as well. So I'm confused and I'm guilty, and I would love to have some advice on how you would handle beginning a polyamorous relationship and how the heck I should talk to a woman.
So you feel gross and creepy when you approach women or when you're around women, and tried to call you, wanted to ask you, are you being gross and creepy when you approach women? Usually people come across as gross and creepy, or they feel gross and creepy. And it would be wonderful if everyone who came across as gross and creepy felt gross and creepy, because then they could self-correct, as perhaps you are attempting to, caller. So good on you. But often when people come across as gross and creepy, it's because they are having a dishonest interaction with someone, because they have an ulterior motive that they haven't placed on the table, because they are weaseling around, trying to get into someone's pants, trying to ask somebody out without actually directly asking them out because they fear rejection and don't want to risk the no. So they don't give that person the opportunity to say no. And that person gets the sense that they're being hit on or asked out without it being direct. And they can't say, look, I'm not interested, when you haven't actually asked them directly if they are, because then they're going to look crazy. And you can say, hey, I wasn't even hitting on you. So if you're being gross and creepy, stop it. If you're talking to women because you're trying to get into their pants and you have an ulterior motive and you're not being honest and direct, be honest and direct. And then you won't have an ulterior motive anymore to have that conversation. And it will feel less gross and less creepy, or not gross or not creepy. You then, however, risk rejection. It'll help if you get on the apps and put yourself out there as somebody who's in a relationship, a woman seeking another woman, perhaps another woman who's in a relationship, a bi woman who wants to have the same kind of first time same sex experience that you want to have. Trust me, the world is crawling with women like you. I hear all the time from women in opposite sex relationships who have always known they were bi or just realized that they're bi, and their partners are like, fine, go for it. Go get yourself some pussy. There are lots and lots and lots of you out there. And sometimes a woman situated in the way you're situated, opposite sex partner, bi, wants to be with another woman, feels self-conscious about approaching lesbians, as if lesbians are the only option. They're not. There are actually three times as many bisexual women as there are lesbian identified women. So hang a shingle. That's what the internet was invented for. And then you put yourself out there, and then people who approach you are expressing an interest in you sexually or romantically. Then you can have a conversation about going out on a date or hanging out or getting to know each other with everyone's motives being explicit. No one has an ulterior motive then. And while it won't feel creepy or gross then, it's still going to feel a little high stakes. You're still going to be nervous. You're still going to get butterflies in your stomach. But you're not going to be manipulating someone because you're having a conversation with them when you have an ulterior motive. Having a conversation about flowers and plants when you actually want is into their pants. As for your boyfriend, you know, there are people out there who have open relationships that are one-sided, where one person has sex with other people and the other doesn't. And some people look at that and think, well, that's unfair. That's the wrong question. What do both parties want? Are both parties happy? If he's happy to let you have sex with other people and has no desire to have sex with other people himself, and you wouldn't want him to have sex with other people, and yeah, that's kind of a contradiction and a little hypocritical, but you can just own that and sit with it and let that be, and it works for both of you, and you're both happy in that relationship, that's fine. And it's not that uncommon, particularly in situations like yours, where it's an opposite sex relationship and one partner is bi and the other partner is like, yeah, go do that same sex thing. Enjoy yourself. I'll meet your dick needs. Other women or another girlfriend can meet your puss needs. That's a wonderful thing that your boyfriend is giving that to you. And finally, caller, although right now you think, I want to sleep with other people and I might take him up on that, but I don't want him sleeping with other people, you may change your mind after you've slept with some other people, because you'll find, most likely, hopefully, best case scenario, after you've slept with some other people, that your feelings for your boyfriend haven't changed at all, that you still love him just as much as you did before, that your connection to him hasn't been diluted or ruined or derailed. And then your worries about what might happen if he sleeps with somebody else won't be so acute, because you will have experienced yourself the truism for many that having sex with somebody other than your partner doesn't take anything away from your partner, and in fact can enhance your relationship with your partner. And you may then find yourself more comfortable with the concept of your boyfriend doing what you have done, some other girl. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, like this little podcast. Listen wherever you want, whenever you want. Our podcast is convenient for you. So why are you still taking trips to the post office when you could be getting postage on demand at Stamps.com? With Stamps.com, you can access all the amazing services of the post office right from your desk 24/7 when it's convenient for you, even when you're listening to the Lovecast. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, using your own computer and printer. Then the mail carrier picks it up. Just click, print, mail, and you are done. It couldn't be easier. Stamps.com is a real boon for business owners who have to do a lot of mailing. Stamps.com is the perfect solution for you folks. And right now, use the code SAVAGE for this special offer. Up to $55 worth of free postage, a digital scale, and a four-week trial. Do not wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in SAVAGE. That's Stamps.com. Enter S-A-V-A-G-E.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 27-year-old queer man living in L.A. It's a story about my ex. My ex and I broke up 2 years ago. After 4 years of dating and 2 years of living together in Seattle, we broke up for a few reasons. She wanted to move back to the Midwest, and I did not. I was struggling to be supportive of her homesickness, and she was really hurt by that. Even though we were very much in love, we were definitely torn by some of our long-term goals. Flash forward to now. After 2 years of pretty much no contact, my ex and I began texting regularly again a few months ago. We began talking weekly after that. And then since I was traveling for work close to her, we decided to go camping together for one night. In a moment, we picked up pretty much where we left off. Nicknames, holding hands, kissing, like our best sex ever. And it really felt like we were in love just like before. We've been back in our respective cities for a few weeks now, but we talk multiple times a week now. We text daily. We tell each other we love each other. Neither of us regrets what happened in the past with us breaking up, and we both kind of viewed the time apart as necessary and good. But I definitely want to be working towards a future with her again. Here's where it gets a little messy. She's moving in a couple months back to the Midwest. She's been very overwhelmed by the prospect of moving, and so having serious talk about us right now has been hard. I've tried to talk about us getting back together, and each time it kind of dead ends. She gets overwhelmed, is stressed, we leave the door open, and kind of walk away saying, I love you. So it's clearly a little confusing. So more or less, I've been taking it day by day with these really intense feelings of joy, talking with her, but also intense feelings of dread, getting entangled with her again. I don't really want to open myself up to losing her again, but I also recognize that I kind of have to if there's any chance of us getting back together. I do want to be in a relationship with her, but I don't want to push the issue because I'm kind of nervous that it's going to overwhelm her. So for the time being, I feel stuck in limbo. So my question, you think I should wait it out, take it slow, keep doing what we're doing, which is this kind of together romantic thing from a distance, and then bring up dating again after she's moved in a couple months? Or should I be completely transparent, explain how hard this is for me, and try and force the conversation sooner rather than later and avoid unnecessarily stringing out my own emotion?
You say you don't want to open yourself up to the pain of losing her again, but guess what? Too late. You've already opened yourself up to the pain of losing her again. Relationships, we're always open to pain. Pain is always a possibility, a negative outcome, a breakup, heartache, always a possibility, even if you two were on the same page about where you wanted to live and other big LTGs, long-term goals. There's always the risk of getting dumped, of it not working out for other reasons. I think the questions you have for me, though, really are a false choice. You're asking whether you should wait it out and take it slow or talk about how you're feeling. And I think you can do both. You can talk about how you're feeling. You can put that on the table. You can be honest and open about where you are right now and take it slow and wait it out. You have no choice, really, when it comes to the waiting it out and taking it slow part, because circumstance is pulling you apart. Circumstance is going to force you guys to slow walk this relationship, to continue to connect, continue to talk, continue to meet up, fly where she is. She can fly where you are. You can go camping again and then see what happens over time. But for your own safety, I think for your own emotional safety, before you completely reinvest in this relationship, you should talk about how hard this is for you. You should talk about how you're feeling. Because if she is not on the same page at all, wouldn't you rather know that now rather than finding that out after you've waited, after you've taken it slow, and then you finally have that conversation that you've been waiting to have for a year or 2 years, and you discover that she wasn't open to this relationship resuming in the same way that you are, and that the last few weeks was a trip down memory lane with some hot sex and camping thrown into the mix. If that's how she's feeling, better you should know that now than after investing more time. If that's how she's feeling, it would be better for you to know that now.
Hi, Dan. I have a question just regarding my kind of first really serious relationship. And I've had, like, you know, long-term relationships in the past, but this is the first time I've lived with somebody. We've only been together about 9 months, but it really feels right. Anyways, it recently came out that he has slept with almost every single one of his close female friends, which it does not bother me that he slept with them. I mean, it bothers me in, like, that small way that, you know, he wasn't always mine or whatever, that possessiveness, but that's not the part that bothers me. The part that bothers me is that we've moved in together and he sort of pressured me into, not pressured me, but he said, you know, these people are really important to me. I want you to have a friendship with them, and kind of made me feel like their approval and their acceptance of me is really important. And I've formed relationships with these people and been really honest about insecurities about my body or insecurities about my relationship or whatever, you know. And now it comes out that he's had sex with not just one, not just two, but like 4, 5, 6 of them. And that's just the part that bothers me, is that I have year-long friendships with these people that sort of feels like based on being very one-sided. And maybe I'm being a huge baby about it. I sort of feel like I am, but it's like the sort of half-truth and the lie of it that I can't really get over. It just feels like his friendship with them was prioritized over his relationship with me. Anyways, just wondering what your thoughts are.
Now you know how we feel, gay guys, because this is really common in gay land, where you meet some guy and you begin to date this guy and you're falling in love with this guy and you meet all of his friends, and it turns out that he slept with all of his friends. It's so common for a gay guy to have slept with his closest friends and for him to have become friends because they hooked up and they really liked each other, but then it wasn't a romantic or intimate connection, but there was a friendship there. It's so common that for a lot of gay guys, there's just this assumption. And the assumption is he's probably already slept with all of his friends anyway. So it's not an issue, typically, when that comes tumbling out. The problem here is your boyfriend pushed you to have relationships with these women, to get to know them and open up to them without telling you who they were to him or what his relationship with them was in the past or how he connected with them. And because you're in straight land, the assumption isn't that a guy has slept with all of his friends, particularly when all of his friends are female. So your boyfriend kind of sent you out there to make these connections, to form these relationships without fully informing you. And that feels a little deceitful, a little manipulative, and setting aside the fact that you like these women, it sounds like you like these women and you had decent, good relationships with these women. So the issue isn't them or anything that they did, although they also didn't disclose. The issue is that he withheld this information, that you weren't just making friends with friends. You were making friends with old FWBs, friends with benefits that had expired by the time you came along, but there you were. My question for you would be, if you had known, if he had told you, would you have run screaming? You meet this guy, you really like this guy, it's only a weekend, and he says, you know, full disclosure, all of my female friends are women I fucked, just so you know. How would you have reacted to the truth being told promptly? When should he have told you this? What would have been the optimal time? A weekend, you would have bolted. A weekend, that would be a really weird thing for someone to tell you. 3 months? 6 months? Sometimes people know that they share some information that'll ruin a new relationship, and it's not really relevant. We don't have to disclose all of our past sexual experiences or encounters to someone when we're dating them. And by the time you feel like, they kind of have a right to know this, you've withheld it so long that you're self-conscious about how long you've withheld this information, and then you delay, you hesitate, you continue to hesitate, and then even more time passes, you become more self-conscious about it. And then finally you tell them, and then it's an issue that you waited so long to tell them. But we can all understand why someone might wait to roll something like that out, because who amongst us hasn't waited and then hesitated and then too much time passed and then you were incredibly self-conscious about telling someone something that they needed to know at some point, but you couldn't tell them right away. The other thing to watch out for is whether this is a pattern. Is this just the one thing he didn't know how to tell you? Had he told other girlfriends that he has a large circle of female friends, all of whom are former sex partners, and those girls instantly dumped him, which made him feel self-conscious, which would explain but not justify not telling you sooner? Well, that might be something you can take into consideration. And if that's part of it, and he hasn't lied to you about anything else, and you like him or love him, maybe you can forgive this.
Hi, Dan. This is a longtime listener from California. Your comments on episode 618 about doctors and their remarks in the medical record, I thought was kind of off. Many medical records make us choose very specific problems for our patients. You know, we can't just put in diabetes. It's diabetes with neurologic complications without the long-term use of insulin. It's a menu that we choose where we choose individual options. So quite likely, the high-risk sexual behavior was, you know, high-risk behavior amongst homosexuals, bisexuals. It probably was a menu of options that they had to choose from. Not saying that there aren't doctors out there who are not sex-friendly. Certainly there are, but I wouldn't necessarily go to this doctor up in arms because it probably wasn't totally their choice. Now, they could just not put that in the record at all and just say exposure to sexually transmitted infections, which is probably a little more broad and all-encompassing, but this might not be their fault. I think you overdid it on that one.
Hi, this is for the woman in episode 618 who was wondering about how to not get so emotionally attached. Yes, everything Dan said, and try dating more guys at once. So instead of investing in one guy for a whole month, date four or five guys at once. And then if one leaves, you're busy because you already have a date the next night.
Hi, Dan. I'm calling in response to on 618, the guy with the wife who doesn't like to give blowjobs. I have to say, I used to be one of those women that did not like to give blowjobs until I got a lesson from my gay boyfriend. Because I think a lot of women think you just, like, take the whole cock in your mouth and deep throat it and you choke and you tolerate it. And some people like that and some people don't. Then I was taught how to use my hands and my mouth at the same time. And it's very enjoyable for the receiving person. And then it's also much better on the person who doesn't really like to gag on a cock. So, oh, I also like a clean shaved cock. Makes it much more pleasant. Good luck.
And we're going to leave it there. I am, of course, as I let you know last week, at home, in bed, packed with Percocet, recovering from my operation. And nothing would make me happier than to see all of you rushing to itmfa.org and ordering some ITMFA and Pete the Motherfucker Already gear. That is the get well card I want from my listeners. Go to itmfa.org. Also, you can order advance tickets for the 14th annual Hump Film Fest at humpfilmfest.com and find out everything you need to know about submitting your dirty little movie to my dirty little film festival. Go to humpfilmfest.com. All right, 206-302-2064 is the number here at the Savage Lovecast. If you'd like to record a question or a comment for a future show, give us a buzz. 206-302-2064. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. Follow Guy Branum on Twitter at Guy Branum. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian and me and the tech-savvy at-risk youth and Nancy. We'll all be back at you next week for an installment of the Savage Lovecast. Thanks for doing it.